Well, I know one person here, Carrie. Where's Carrie? Carrie is somewhere. I can't see her. There she is, waving. Carrie knows. Carrie used to house sit for us, so she knows my scarily intelligent tabby cat Mousel, mouse hole. The Mousel sits on Nancy's lap, my partner's lap, and she needs Nancy's tummy. The picture of contentment and ecstasy. Lucky cat, says Nancy, living in this moment, not worrying about mortality. We grew up with that picture of evolution in our heads, that diagram of evolution, the creatures, the fish turning into, and then the reptiles, the amphibians, and they're emerging onto the land, and finally at the apex is man, as if we were the culmination and peak, the supreme achievement of the world. I've been thinking lately that human beings' brains are an evolutionary aberration, a weird accident. We don't really need all this sensitivity, all this awareness, all this quest for meaning. All we really need is a tribe for company and a good supply of berries and nuts. But no, that wasn't enough for us. We had to have cities and pyramids, steamships, slavery, war, and oil pipelines. Evolution has cursed us with this oh-so-sensitive mind. It brings us the joys of Beethoven, sushi, figure skating, and the fear of our end. We see the passage of time. We experience wrenching losses. We sense our own end approaching, and we wonder what lies on the other side of life. This is not a sermon about loss or mourning or even about dying. Those are huge subjects worthy of a long, depressing sermon series. I just, for some reason, felt called to explore for myself and to put into a sermon something I'd never in 20 years of ministry preached about, the afterlife, what happens after we die. And exploring this was difficult and kind of painful and weird. But I'll start with this. I lost my innocent, rudimentary Christian faith when I was 12. After doing a research for a paper on world religions for social studies, I learned from the one book I consulted that all the religions of the world thought that they were right, and I concluded from this that they must therefore all be wrong. And my little faith fell away like a chrysalis, and I quietly and firmly became an atheist. I read the daily paper and frequently found myself in tears when I read about airplane crashes, which there seemed to be a lot of in those days, thinking about the finality of it all for the first time, really thinking about the finality of death. I was a fairly happy atheist for the next 2 decades, but when I was around 30 or so, beset by too many questions that science didn't answer well enough, I reluctantly and rebelliously said, "This is a job for religion." And dragging my feet, I went looking for one. I once heard about a man, a colleague of mine had, knew this guy, this is a real person, who went church shopping and considered many different denominations before choosing the Southern Baptists because they had the worst version of hell, and he figured if they were right, he wanted to be on their team. Well, I went church shopping, and at first I found a church that had pretty good answers for everything. But then, perversely, I joined up with the Unitarian Universalists, a church that had no answers at all about the afterlife. If you today look on the UUA website, you will see these words. Two of the big questions religions have sought to answer over the years are, Why does life exist as we know it, and what happens after we die? Unitarian Universalism won't promise you ironclad answers to these questions, but we will promise you a community of learning and support in which we are all making meaning of life and death. You call this a religion? My first Unitarian Universalist minister, Kirk, a really, really great guy, really nice guy, introduced me to this strange new faith. And I asked him once, how did he comfort people when they were dying? He said he asked them what they believed and then explored that with them. All very well, I suppose. Probably people who join the Unitarian Universalist Church do not usually do so out of concerns about the afterlife, but out of a desire to explore meaning in this life and to create a better world in the company of like-minded folks. Still, I hardly think we are immune to the common human situation of waking in the middle of the night with a heart-sinking fear of the void. The early American Unitarians believed in an afterlife. They believed in a loving, merciful, and patient God who would nonetheless, he'd wait for a while, but nonetheless he would punish those who steadfastly resisted the call to moral living. These upper middle class religious liberals, I'm hearing a high-pitched sound. Is that a communication from beyond? Is it somebody's hearing aid? Okay. I'll just ignore it then. So these upper middle class religious liberals were so devoted to reform movements of all kinds, their struggle against ignorance and injustice and slavery gave their lives so much meaning that some of them could scarcely picture heaven without a continuation of these efforts, and imagine heaven as an ongoing process of improvement and meaningful struggle. After a lot of digging, I found proof of this. This is from William Ellery Channing. He founded the American Unitarian Association. His discourse preached on Easter 1834. This is one of those, 15,000-word sermons. Here's one paragraph. The good, on approaching Jesus, this is after death, going into heaven, hey, Jesus, the good, on approaching Jesus, will not only sympathize with his spirit, but will become joint workers, active, efficient ministers in accomplishing his great work of spreading virtue and happiness. We must never think of heaven as a state of inactive contemplation or of unproductive feeling. So much for those who dreamed of heaven as a park-like place of rest and relaxation. Now it would still be a place for good works. The classic Universalist preachers, on the other hand, said that we humans did indeed suffer the pains of hell and the joys of heaven based on our behaviors, but it was only in this lifetime. After death, everyone, sinner or saint, would go to heaven. Whether immediately or after a period of time was much debated, but the Universalists believed so strongly in a loving God that they knew in their bones God would not punish people for eternity in the afterlife. Now, if you have them, you might want to take out a pen and paper, because I will now tell you the absolutely definitive answer about the afterlife. I'm just kidding, actually. Whatever I said, you would surely resist and poke at. If I said, after you die, you go to a beautiful place where all your relatives will greet you and you'll be happy for all eternity, you'd say, oh yeah, how do you know? And if I said, there's absolutely nothing, just oblivion, you'd say, oh yeah, how do you know? And rightly so, because the fact is, no one knows. today, 26 years after I first walked into a UU church and asked the minister, Kirk, about his beliefs about the afterlife, I'm now Facebook friends with him. And so I asked Kirk what his beliefs are today. He wrote, "My take is pretty simple. It's the same perspective I take when asked about the existence of God. Basically, the afterlife and God are irrelevant to me. My take is that if there is a God and if there is an afterlife or not, I will strive to be the best human being I can be. If there is a God, then he, she should be pleased. If there is an afterlife, then I'm in the door. If there are more requisites, then I'd rather not bother." And by best human being I can be, I mean to live by values and principles that define for me what it means to be a good human being. For me, that is defined by the Buddhist Eightfold Path and the Unitarian Universalist principles. It's a lifetime endeavor and commitment. I wonder how many of you are deeply at peace about the afterlife. How many of you feel completely at ease with whatever you envision on the other side of death, whether it's oblivion or reincarnation or an experience of everlasting unity. I wonder how many of you deeply fear the whole topic and avoid thinking about it as much as possible. And I wonder how many of you feel as I do, torn and confused, alternating perhaps between a Unitarian hyper-rational attitude of when we die, that's it, and a universalist faith that at the heart of all existence, there is an eternal and all-accepting love. At 4 a.m., do you ever awaken in a panic and lie awake face-to-face with a fear of oblivion? On a sunny, glorious day, or in the depths of prayer or meditation, do you feel an indescribable connection and reassurance, as I have been blessed to experience a handful of times, a wordless reassurance, a cradling, an embrace? How important is it, after all, what we believe about the afterlife? To my friend Kirk, it's not important at all. But what if our beliefs about the afterlife actually make our lives better or worse right now? What if our beliefs about the afterlife actually have the power to make us either more unhappy, unkind, judgmental, and disconnected, or more contented, active, generous, and connected? What if our beliefs about the afterlife have the power to give our lives meaning and richness? And what if we could actually entertain the notion that our beliefs about the afterlife might change and evolve, just as our beliefs about all kinds of things have changed and evolved throughout our lifetimes? My colleague, the Unitarian Universalist minister, Alison Farnham, told a wonderful story about something that happened at her grandmother's funeral. The Christian minister said, "Imagine that your Creator especially selected a gift for you on the day you were born. Your Creator wrapped it up in beautiful paper with shiny ribbons, only to be opened on the day you die." Alison realized as she was there at her grandmother's funeral that she could imagine exactly what that gift was. Her grandmother would be greeted by her parents. She'd be at her beloved lake splashing about and going water skiing. And so Alison says, "I was given by this fabulous minister the gift of thinking what I would want. Not if I think it's real or rational, but what I want. And thinking about that has helped me prioritize what I value. What is heaven? As you use, we try to make heaven on earth in the here and now. But by thinking about what comes after, it may affect how we are in the here and now. I'd like to hear some amens if you agree with any of this. In our Unitarian Universalist faith, we tend to have an over-reliance on the head and not enough reliance on the heart. Okay, what if we corrected that just a little? What if we softened our focus on reason and materialism and loosened up our imaginations about what could happen after death? What if we approached it not with fear and dread, not with indifference and detachment, but in an imaginative, creative, and playful spirit, like that wonderful author of Dog Heaven? If freedom is a core value for Unitarian Universalists, why not exercise our freedom to be playful, to choose what we'd like our afterlife to be like, and then try to make our remaining days as much like that as we can? And if you feel like saying, good point. What I find most deeply reassuring is that profound truth that we acknowledge in our seventh principle, the interconnected nature of all being. That insight that St. Paul had when he wrote to his brethren in Rome, "I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God." It is a scientific truth that the atoms that comprise our being are immortal. They were created in the earliest era of our universe. These particular atoms have come together for a while as a gift, as an accident, as a blessing, to comprise what we call me and you. And as Thich Nhat Hanh says, after the conditions for me and you to exist as separate beings disappear, these atoms don't perish, but transform and become part of other beings. Journalist Aaron Friedman wrote a very interesting little essay called "Why You Want a Physicist to Speak at Your Funeral." He says, "You'll want the physicist to explain to those who loved you that they need not have faith. Indeed, they should not have faith. Let them know that scientists have measured precisely the conservation of energy and found it accurate, verifiable, and consistent across space and time. You can hope your family will examine the evidence and satisfy themselves that the science is sound and that they'll be comforted to know your energy's still around. According to the law of the conservation of energy, not a bit of you is gone. You're just less orderly." Well, this is painful. This is painful when we cling to the idea that our unique personality and accomplishments and loves will one day disappear forever. It's so painful when we choose to identify with our solitariness, our uniqueness, our separateness. And this is profoundly comforting when we choose to deeply embrace the insight that life and death are both illusions. It is profoundly comforting when we choose to identify with our connection, with the primacy not of separateness, but of relationship, with the knowing that there is only one unimaginably vast being, which we may call the universe or God or love, which manifests in a myriad ways as the ocean manifests as waves which come in and out of visible being, but never, ever lose their connection with the all that is. our Unitarian dependence on reason can deprive us of insights into the real nature of life and death that are best expressed in metaphor and image and music and playful exercise of the imagination. For a rich resource of the latter, I recommend the book Sum, which is spelled S-U-M, 40 Tales from the Afterlives by David Eagleman. Eagleman is a neuroscientist, and he wrote Sum to explore 40 different possible visions of the afterlife. There is the afterlife where you discover that your creator is a species of small, dim-witted, obtuse creatures who keep asking you, "Do you have answer?" Or there is the afterlife in which we discover our true essences, that we are, in fact, enormous, nine-dimensional beings charged with the maintenance of the cosmos. When we are exhausted by the work, we are reincarnated as humans and abandon our huge responsibilities. There's the afterlife where you get to choose whatever you want to be in the next life. Eagleman proposes an individual who, in search of a simpler life, decides to become a horse. But during his metamorphosis, realizes that the slide down the intelligence ladder is irreversible. You forget what it was like to be a human, wondering what it was like to be a horse. And then there's the afterlife populated only by people you remember. After a while, you begin to notice that there's no opportunity of meeting strangers, and the world is actually empty. He says, you begin to complain about all the people you could be meeting, but no one listens or sympathizes with you because this is precisely what you chose when you were alive. These ideas of Eagleman's are skits on the conundrums of creation itself. God is variously imagined as male, female, non-existent, or concerned only with microbes. We are an accidental and irrelevant byproduct. Eagleman says that none of these 40 stories is meant to be taken as serious theological proposals, but instead that the message of the book is the importance of exploring new ideas beyond the ones that have been traditionally passed down to us. And Eagleman describes himself as a possibilian. Possibilianism is a philosophy which rejects both the claims of traditional theism and the positions of certainty in strong atheism in favor of a middle exploratory ground. Asked whether he was an atheist or a religious person, Eagleman replied, "I call myself a possibilian. I'm open to ideas that we don't have any way of testing right now. Our ignorance of the cosmos is too vast to commit to atheism, and yet we know too much to commit to a particular religion." A third position, agnosticism, is often an uninteresting stance in which a person simply questions whether his traditional religious story is true or not true. But with possibilianism, I'm hoping to define a new position, one that emphasizes the exploration of new unconsidered possibilities. Possibilianism is comfortable holding multiple ideas in mind. It is not interested in committing to any particular story. I became instantly converted to possibilianism when I read that. And in that spirit, I would like to just close with two images or possibilities of the afterlife that have been very meaningful to me over decades now. The first is that excerpt from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki that I shared as a meditation. The image of our individual lives as drops of water leading a difficult existence as they fall, and death as emerging and an end to the pain of separateness. And another metaphor that I find deeply meaningful is from a poem by Jan Seale called Nape, Nape of the Neck. in this poem, she talks about the nape of the neck and the idea of resurrection. It's a poem about Easter, but this is the part that I love. She says, "When I die, I'd rather not be redeemed like a gymnast recovering on a trampoline, springing from grave to feet, blinded by an eastern sun. Rather, let God come like a thick, dumb mother cat, pick up what's left by the nape of its neck, and move it to safe quarters." When I officiate at memorial services, it is a difficult matter to find something reassuring and yet heartfelt and honest to say to the mourners who may comprise a wide assortment of beliefs. So I talk about the predominant value at the core of our universalist faith, which is love. I say, I believe that in some mysterious manner, we live on after our deaths in those things and people that in life we loved the most. So, sisters and brothers, may we contemplate deeply those things that we love the most, embracing both the pain and the glory of them, that the days we do have will be made glad. And may we be possibilians, permitting ourselves the freedom to imagine an afterlife filled with the greatest joys, the best love, the most justice, that we may be moved to continue to help create sparkling fragments of heaven here on earth. So may it be for all of us. Amen.